Friends, in today's episode, Erica Gregorich joins us from Arkansas to share her stories as a stage 4 breast cancer patient, a professor at the university level, and a single mother. She has a teenage daughter and a 4-year-old son. Erica provides powerful insight to our listeners, sharing the difficulties and successes of balancing her life as a mom with a terminal disease, along with the other major responsibilities that comes with being a cancer patient. We appreciate that despite such a heavy topic, Erica leads the discussion with grace, positivity, love, and honesty. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
Well, cool. Thanks for joining us, Erica.
Absolutely.
My name's Andrew. Yeah. And we have this podcast that we're working on. It's called the Death with Dignity podcast, but it basically is a podcast discussing medical aid in dying and interviewing different people involved in the medical field, doctors. We got a chance to talk with our state senator here in California. We've talked with different patients as well, just kind of on the whole topic to, in an effort to, I guess, raise awareness and, shed some light on the topic, I guess. I'm a cancer patient myself, and this is something that I may pursue at some point if it's needed or if I feel like I, need that option. So, yeah, and Hasban's been helping the whole time. He's got his own digital marketing company, RS Media, and they've been a super big help. So, Hasban, if you got anything to add, jump in.
Yeah, just I'm a friend of Andrew's and like roommate, and we started this whole thing as just like more of an idea. We just used to have talks between us, and I thought that this would be cool to do. And we started doing it, and it's been a really cool effort. I mean, besides raising like awareness, I think it's just been a really cool and just a really cool process, and just like learning about the field and what's happening. We've talked to a lot of cool people, and we're like excited to talk to you as well, like today.
It's interesting because, people like us who have stage 4 cancer or who are dying, we want to talk about it. And so when we find other people who want to talk about it, we're like, ooh, goody, let's chat, So, I actually, I just think of 100 people I'd love to refer you guys to, but you're probably in the loop with, I'm sure you have 100 folks on your list already, but I'm thinking of somebody that I got to know recently. She just flew to New Mexico. That's where I worked to get legislation passed as an advocate, psychiatric social worker too. So there's that background, but she was in Massachusetts where my brother lives, and I'm looking at what's going on there because I'm currently living in Arkansas. So I'm like, well, that's where my brother is. If I get sick, I might go stay with him, but it's not passing in Massachusetts. So she flew to New Mexico and she's picked her date and everything. I think she chose the 13th or the 17th. I can't recall, but she has friends that are going to fly in and she's staying at a little place so she can access it in New Mexico. But I mean, it's a whole culture of people now, we're like rerouting people to different states.
Yeah, so that's wild.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Control over their healthcare. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of work to be done for sure. You don't want to hear about those types of stories where people kind of need to uproot their lives to access something like this. You'd think at this stage of the game, you'd think there'd be enough empathy and compassion to provide this option to those who are in need of it or seeking it, that qualify for it under the guidelines.
You sound like you're from Wisconsin.
Close. Illinois. So Chicago.
All right,
area.
I was close.
Yeah, Midwest. I lived in Michigan as well for quite a
Michigan.
While.
Michigan. All right. Yeah. All right. I was born in Michigan, but I've been in the South long enough to Sound like it. Yeah. Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's really frustrating to me is that it is supported by so many people. I mean, it is supported by the majority of people, but right. It's places like Arkansas where I asked a Republican, interestingly, I mean, it's not partisan even, I asked a Republican legislator who had tried to get some momentum in Arkansas, any kind of traction. And he said that there's some religious group that has informed legislators that if they support medical aid in dying, that they will lose their financial backing. And apparently it's sufficient enough to scare people off from supporting it. And I just think that is some shit right there.
Yeah.
I don't get
discouraging. It always seems like it comes back to money in a sense. And in this case to those who oppose it, it seems like the religious piece is heavily involved as well. That's kind of what we've been finding. But like you said as well, you talk to, your average individual and even people with heavy religious beliefs, it seems like they do support that as an option for others. It's only when you get, from our understanding, when you get to kind of the higher up the organizations where they really, some of these groups really shun this idea. So it's pretty disappointing. And then, of course, when you're that high up, they're the ones who hold all the power and the money and can actually kind of wield that influence. But hopefully people will kind of get thick enough skin and get going on some of that legislation. I was saying I lived in Illinois for many years. My mom is still there, and along with other family members, and they do not have medical aid in dying as a law or accessible for people. So we're working with Compassion and Choices a little bit just to kind of maybe get the ball rolling, talk with some legislators or something. We'll see. But it's a process.
You ever detassel any corn in Illinois?
What's that?
You ever detassel any corn up in Illinois?
No, not quite. I lived outside of Chicago, about 40 minutes, Naperville suburb. Not a whole lot of corn, although it's not too far. I mean, let's be honest, you just got to drive about, 20.
That's all there minutes. Is, Chicago and corn. Yeah, so it was one of the two. Yeah, that was my next question, Chicago or corn? All right.
Oh, yeah. But tell us about yourself. What are you doing in Arkansas? You said that you were born in Michigan. You got a brother on the East Coast.
Yeah.
What's going on down there for you?
Well, I was in New Mexico when I was diagnosed. I was 37, I think. I can't even remember anymore. I think I was 37. I was pregnant at the time. I actually decided to have a child on my own. I went to a sperm bank. I didn't go there physically, but I hopped online and I always knew I wanted to be a mom again. My daughter I've had since I was 21. She's almost 20 herself now. And I just always want a kid, but I'll be darned if I can't get along with, I can't play well with others. So I decided to just do it by myself. And I was pregnant with my son and I was about, I was almost done. With a pregnancy, but I had a lump on my breast, and my mom's been through breast cancer twice postmenopausal. So we didn't think that the genetic component would be too big of an issue. Also, just for all women who might be listening to this, I had real lumpy breasts. And so I'd had like maybe 5 or 6 biopsies before, just worried, cause mom had cancer, all negative. No, it's just a cyst or this, that, or the other, or, fibroid or whatever. And so I'd gotten to the point where I was like, it's just another lump. And, boobs change when you're pregnant. And so, I went in and I was massively pregnant, and they started putting the wand in my armpit and really kind of like digging in there. And I was like, oh crap, man, I know what that means. For my mom, she never had past stage 1. She was caught it real early. And I never would have imagined that I'd be somebody who didn't get there in time, but it was fast moving as it is often with young people. And so they induced my labor like in the next couple of days. had my son, and then I had to heal before I could start treatment because you're kind of busted up after birthing. So started my treatment, and it just wasn't working. They had identified it as triple negative breast cancer, which is really aggressive and hard to treat. Just chemo after chemo wasn't getting anywhere. When you have like tangible lumps, I don't know what kind of cancer you have, but it's a different thing to be able to look at your cancer, you know, and I don't know if it's better or worse. I'm not going to make that judgment, but I don't know. You know, just this hard, shadowy bump that would grow or shrink sometimes with treatment. And it would worry me, like, or I'd worry it, you know, physically. And so, I decided I wanted to have a mastectomy. And so I did, and they took it off, took another look at it, and found that it wasn't triple negative. It was HER2 positive. And, they put me on Herceptin Perjeta. I actually tried immunotherapy that had made some, like progress, but couldn't really tolerate the treatment. But, I've been on Herceptin Perjeta for a couple of years now, and, you know, it shows no evidence of disease, but we know what stage four means. It means it's likely still there. And anytime I try to talk about, can I maybe not do chemo anymore? My doctor's like, nope. So yeah, I had chemo today actually. So I was feeling a little bit irpy before getting on, but not too bad. So I was like, we're going to do it. So
that's cool. Yeah. Thanks for taking that time. Even on a day like today, those can be tough days for sure. That was going to be one of my questions. What have the side effects been like for you as you've gone through these different chemo regimes and treatment regimes?
I'm really lucky to be on the regimen I'm on now, because, you know, if I had been Red Devil for every 3 weeks, I think I just would have given up. Like, that was so hard.
What was it called again?
The Red Devil. I can't even remember what the real name is, because it looks like Kool-Aid, and I've actually heard
literally that same term from other people. So it must be like kind of common in the community. Tell us what that's all about, or kind of what that was like, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I remember getting in the shower and just being like, and like having to squat and like just try and keep my crap together. I just couldn't function on it. To have healthcare at our age, gotta have work. Well, not exactly anymore, but you know, there are options. But there's something about dropping good healthcare that you just don't want to do. I've been told so many times, girl, you got good healthcare. And it's true. I mean, it'll cover things. So for example, I have my Herceptin Perjeta. Anybody on Herceptin Perjeta? It was just recently, like the last year, it was you can have it in a push subcutaneous shot that takes 5 minutes. It's a slow push, but the big old needle, they come in, they slow push it, but that beats 4-hour drip, right? So the FDA just approved it recently, and I pushed. My background as a geriatric social worker has come in handy. So I pushed and I advocated, and I'm not a very nice patient, I'm sure, but nobody else has it. The nurses that inject me are always like, what is this? I've never seen anything like this. What a great option. I'm like, will you tell people? And they're like, oh, well, their insurance probably wouldn't cover it. So back to my original thing, I don't want to drop my good health insurance and start those battles all over again. So yeah, I hang on to my work. Plus I like my work, but I forgot even why I was talking about that.
Well, tell us a little bit about your work as well. And you mentioned social work. Are you still involved in that field?
I was a geriatric social worker for about 6 years. And then I went back and got my PhD in public policy. And then went the route of academia. So while I was in academia as a professor, you know, teaching, doing research and things like that, I still did some practice in the community in Las Cruces, New Mexico, where I started. I lived there for oh gosh, how many years? 5 years before I had to move back when I got sick. But So I practiced still a little bit in a community clinic there. But really I've switched gears, and honestly, since COVID has happened, it's really good that I can do my work online, but I still teach students in New Mexico State University virtually. I'm used to Zoom, very comfortable with it. And I'm still able to do a lot of my work, which does revolve around end of life care in some instances. So I was very interested, and actually I had lobbied with my students in 2017 in Santa Fe in New Mexico for the passage of medical aid in dying. It did not pass then. I was healthy then, and then had to lobby virtually in 2021, but we got it passed. I mean, my job is kind of a patchwork now of research, teaching, service, advocacy, and I've always worked with people who have memory disorders, movement disorders, or, you know, kind of serious chronic health issues.
So it seems like it kind of came together in a sense. Tell us a little bit more, if you don't mind, about the geriatric social worker role and just what that entails. And just some of that piece, if you don't mind.
There's so many opportunities for geriatric social work, and it's so hard to explain what we do, but it's so important. It's when people say case management, it sounds so simple. We have some social workers at the master's level, LCSWs, licensed clinical social workers, that go into therapy, you know, so they're just, you know, they practice therapy. But in other settings like healthcare, it might be part therapy, part advocacy, you know, all those phone calls that it takes to get the insurance to do what it was designed to do. You know, the collaboration of various agencies, organizations, practitioners, getting on a page. It takes a coordinator. And so social workers do a lot of that. We did support groups. I had a Parkinson's disease, a support group for caregivers and their patients. When I first started, it's kind of a catch-all of supports. It's like your personal superhero. That's what social workers are, I think.
They are pretty amazing individuals. I teach special education. So between working with social worker at the school level to my social worker at the cancer center, you know, they're, like you said, are a lot of different roles, and you people certainly, I think, make it very positive difference. So we appreciate that. And then just to clarify for the listeners, so geriatric, that is leading more towards people on the older kind of end of life, not necessarily end of life spectrum, but just older age, I suppose.
Well, so when I worked at the senior health clinic, it was kind of wonderful because we had people who were just coming because, oh, I'm on Medicare, I'm going to go ahead and do a lot of preventive type measures. And so we would come in and work with them on, more prevention, like what are your health practices? You know, how can we support you in your retirement and things like that. And then also within that clinic, they had the memory center and the movement disorders clinic. So we also served people who were having, you know, neurological or degenerative diseases that were going to impact them and their family for a long period of time. And so, you know, kind of getting involved and making sure they have all the supports they need in the home. It was a nice mix. I always enjoyed that. I like having a variety of things to work on. I don't want to be doing the same thing. So that was always enjoyable.
Some
really impressive older adults, and then, you know, others that, you know, were having challenges.
Sure. Very cool. What would you say to people listening who might need to access some sort of support like that, or where would people get started? They needed,
I would say,
even if it's as simple as preventative, or if they're in need of, you know, more support.
I was lucky enough to work with some amazing geriatricians at the senior health clinic in Fayetteville, Arkansas. But I mean, geriatricians are just much more likely to work on interprofessional teams. I mean, I don't know what it is, if it's reimbursement rates that makes that possible, or what the situation is exactly, but palliative care, hospice care, geriatricians almost always work on teams. Neurologists, neuropsychologists, they're usually functioning, not, you know, in isolation, which I think is what makes it so wonderful. So what I would say to anybody who's 65 is if you can find a geriatrician, somebody who's working with an interprofessional team, that takes Medicare, and primarily works with Medicare patients, they're going to be seeing you for longer. They're going to be practicing more holistically. They're going to be looking at taking you off like any kind of medications that are duplicated. You're going to get to meet, you know, it's just, it's more, whole person oriented care. And so, yeah, it's great when you have your family practitioner that you've been with for so, so long, but maybe it'd be good to get a different perspective if you can find a really good geriatrician.
Yeah, it never hurts to have a fresh set of eyes on something, yeah, regardless of the position in terms of that health piece. So very, thanks for that. That's good information. It seems like sometimes our planning with some of the end of life stuff isn't as, we don't focus on that stuff as much. And before we really move on to some of the other stuff, I got lots of questions about your role as a social worker, but what was one of the more difficult aspects of your in that role? You mentioned memory care. I have both two of my grandparents on both my mom and dad's side had ended up having dementia and Alzheimer's, and really it was a hard end of life experience because they were basically a shell of themselves at the end of their lives. So very difficult, but so that's hard to see. I can imagine that would be difficult and take a toll. What was some of the more challenging aspects of that job?
You know, interestingly, and I think this applies to both you and myself as well, I think that some of the hardest parts of my job was when I was working in movement disorders and it was younger people. Huntington's disease is one of the most difficult things I've ever witnessed people go through. Woody Guthrie had Huntington's disease. And that's an interesting, you know, backstory there, but it can affect people psychologically. It kicks in right about 40, right? And your children have a 50% likelihood of having it. So a lot of times, you know, a daughter or a son might come in with their parent, you know, to support them as they're going through their diagnosis. And then they're sitting in the room and the recognition hits them like, oh, you're saying that there's a 50% chance that I also am facing what now I know my parent has been going through and will continue to suffer from. I remember when I was an intern, way before I even went into movement disorders, one of the most impacting things I saw was them take a Huntington's patient off from hospice. This woman was bedbound, writhing, just constant writhing, constant movement. It's a movement disorder, right? Contractions and just, I mean, just, yeah, a shell of a human is what I felt like I was witnessing. And they were taking her off of hospice because her prognosis was that she would live longer than 6 months. And the concern and the reason for my visit was, what supports is this family going to have, right? And so I think that for me, developmentally, being young, still like, you know, having this like, okay, I guess I can't plan anymore, like can't plan for very much. I don't know, I can have a job, but am I going to be able to have a career? I don't know, probably not. So, you know, seeing those situations where, I don't know, it is painful when people who are older adults are diagnosed with things like that. I am not trying to diminish the pain for those people or their families, but there's something more expected about it. And I think professionally when I was young and still personally, I think that loss of potential or a longer life is just really hard.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. And that is hard. And I think everyone's got, you know, it's probably different for everybody. And I just appreciate you taking that risk and sharing that. How about some of the more gratifying things? Any specific memory that really stands out, something that you really was positive from that job and having that role?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So many things. I work with wonderful people. I really love doing home visits when I worked in Las Cruces and being able to visit people in their home environments. I think that you can learn so much more. And I wish that healthcare would reimburse better for things like that. Not just when people are in end of life, you know, for hospice, but earlier, like in palliative care situations, to allow for those home visits, because they're just so much more revealing. I really enjoyed that, especially just loved exploring Las Cruces. It's just such a unique and wonderful culture down there. So excited I get to go back in a couple of weeks to visit. So yeah, I think that, and then just working on a team of other professionals and seeing people collaborate. I mean, it's just so nice when it's seamless, right? Like everybody has their roles and you pick up where the other leaves off, and you have one patient and maybe, you know, the neurologist is the person that's going to be, you know, in the driver's seat, you know, driving that patient care. But then other patients, you know, it would be, you know, the social worker is going to have to go in there and, you know, take care of a few things and, you know, find some supports before we can even think about medications or treatments. It's just, you know, you just have to address certain things first. So working with people who just, it was smooth transition and good collaboration. It was just my favorite part of my work. Yeah. And awesome. Humor. There's a lot of humor in healthcare.
Yeah. You got to be able to laugh at some of this stuff. No doubt. And so you're still working now, right? You said in a role as an instructor or professor.
Yeah.
Very cool. What's your schedule like with that? And how does your current, I guess, set up with treatments and everything intertwine?
Oh, I never plan anything for like the day of chemo, but I figured, you know, I wouldn't have to be on like too much for this. So I hope that's the case. I hope you're forgiving.
This is awesome. I'm definitely enjoying our discussion. And again, really appreciate that you're doing this on a chemo day, because those are definitely grueling.
Yeah. I lose my train of thought. So that's the thing, is if I'm trying to teach or if I have to give a presentation or something, even if it's not really because of that, I feel like it is, or I just don't feel 100% and I really want to give it my all my enthusiasm and focus. And, but yeah, what's really amazing is how much I've been able to continue my job. I mean, COVID has been awful. But I think that my director and my colleagues now, you know, understand and believe that I can continue to do my job from a distance, and I'm able to do work with like program assessment, still at a distance, and, teaching by Zoom is, you know, the norm. So that's, you know, more than acceptable. I think that I've sort of, it's been interesting because I want to support my students as much as I can, because while this has been really hard for, you know, me and everybody, students who are trying to go through school right now, holy smokes, man. I mean, I was so stressed out when I was a student, you know, trying to work and go to school and manage all this. I think it was some of the most stressful times of my life, and they're doing it through COVID. So I try and meet with them live, so it's not just all asynchronous and dry. But I really am impressed with their ability to push through. I can't imagine it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's been a massive change for a lot of people, and agreed. I really give our kids credit. As mentioned, I teach special education and my students are pretty impacted by their disabilities, but they were tremendous when we were needing to go online, especially when the pandemic initially was starting. Really adapted well, and their families were tremendous with the support. So it was nice.
Oh my gosh, the families. How do they maintain jobs when they have a special needs kid? And I mean, oh my gosh,
It's tough. It was tough on, everyone, right? The whole world. It's crazy. And it's nice that we're finally kind of, feels like we're kind of moving in a better direction. So it is good.
Yeah, it does.
And for myself, and it sounds like you as well, there was certainly that silver lining with the pandemic, in that I was able to go back and teach virtually from home as well. At that time, I was on a different type of treatment regime and at home, because it was just kind of, it would have been hard to be, you know, on campus teaching. And so that basically opened up the door to stay involved, teach online.
And you're going to be able to continue to do that?
Well, our kids are back on campus now, and I had been working up until December. And in December, I kind of fell ill, ended up in the hospital for a little bit, got out feeling good. And then in January, I started a new treatment regime and wanted to take a little time just to give the body a little time to adjust and see how things are going. And so far, it's been going pretty good. Can't complain. My doc is really happy with some of the results from the scans and blood work. So I'm hoping maybe if things keep moving in a good direction to get back in there, maybe sometime after spring break, we'll see.
Nice. Very nice.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It's high demand for your position. So that's good.
Right. Yeah. And I've been so fortunate. I work with such a wonderful group of people and they've been so supportive and helpful, donating time off, making meals, you know, helping, swinging by, laundry, all kinds of stuff. So really makes it a lot easier, because some of this stuff can be a little daunting if you're doing it by yourself.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So tell me about medical aid in dying and how you learned about it and the whole idea and everything. Was it something you knew about before you were sick? Was it something that you learned about after treatments through a doctor? I mean, you're involved in social work, so maybe you already knew all this stuff, but fill us in a little bit on that topic.
Yeah, I don't think I probably knew about the momentum that was happening, you know, over the last 5 years with so many states having passed legislation. I don't think I really knew it was gaining traction when it was. I knew about it and I knew I had opinions, you know, related to it, but nothing super close. I mean, I grew up with a crotchety old dad that was always saying like, well, if I ever get that, you know, I'm just going to walk into the woods and never come back. And, you know, I don't know, it's just not really it. So that kind of mentality is not shocking to me. And not a particularly spiritual family. I guess I was just sort of designed to support that. Plus being a social worker, you know, self-determination is at the heart of a lot of what we do. Like I said, we lobbied for it before I was ill. There's a movie, and I never watched movies twice, but I had watched it twice before I got sick. And it's not exactly medical aid in dying related, because the guy's not terminally ill, but he's a quadriplegic, but it's a beautiful movie. The Sea Within. Oh my goodness. It's just amazing. I can't remember the name of the actor, but he's famous. And I think it's in Spanish, but anyway, there's subtitles. Bardo, I can't remember the name of the guy, but just beautiful actor. I'd always kind of felt like this, you know, sympathy towards that. I wasn't really entrenched in it. I think that, like a lot of people I know who have stage 4 disease, it catches our interest and we want to make a difference. I mean, there's something about being terminally ill that makes you think like, what is my time being used for? You know, am I using it to really enjoy my moments with my children? And also, you just want to do good. Like, you want to leave the world with a positive balance, you know, like we all fuck up and, oh, I'm sorry. I shouldn't say that. I don't know
what the podcast says about F words,
but you can bleep that out later.
I'm a hockey player. The colorful language, fine. You're fine.
Okay. We all make mistakes in life and maybe, you know, go off our, you know, straight and narrow path for a few years or, you know, but when you really are face to face with it, you it becomes really important. You want to leave with a positive balance. And something that is right there within grasp is something that's meaningful to, you know, yourself. And so that's one thing that I've chosen to be really active in, is advocating for medical aid in dying. And plus, you know, I become close with other people who are dying, and, you know, seeing them go through what they're going through and the pain and the discomfort. Like I said, the woman who's moved to New Mexico, you become, you know, close to these people. And it's also, I like control. I like to control my circumstances as much as possible. And it's not necessarily pain, although I truly do not want to be in pain. And I've experienced a great deal of physical pain through this process. So I know that breakthrough pain, or just, you know, that is a reality. I know that hospice is a wonderful thing, but I like the idea of leaving on my own terms. And I think that if other people want that, whatever their terms are, they should be allowed that as well. And I think also, I've heard many beautiful stories about hospice, but it's just not always, it just doesn't always go this way. But to be able to kind of say goodbye with your family, like plan your death, I mean, that sounds ideal in a totally non-ideal situation that none of us can avoid. So yeah, I think that's what I think about medical aid and dying. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing. Yeah, powerful stuff. Do you think that we have a difficult time discussing death and dying in this country or society, specifically, I guess, in America?
Yes, I have. Yeah. The only thing that I wanted in support from my friends, and that I've gotten, thankfully, but that I directly asked for, was just, please let me talk about this. It sucks, but, you know, God, please just sit there and listen.
And did they?
Because, yeah. Nobody talks about it. And I probably make a lot of people uncomfortable, because now I'm sort of consumed with the idea, you know, but not really. Obviously, I'm very busy with plenty of other things. But yeah, we do. We don't talk about it. And it's so it's such an avoidance of something that, you know, yeah, is so real. I don't know.
Did you, if you don't mind me asking, did your friends or whoever support you in that? Were they able to talk with you and support you and listen or guide you in any way? Or was it, I'm sure it was difficult as well.
Yeah. I've had at least a few very good friends who have been willing to listen to the difficult stuff. Thankfully, I've done that for them in other circumstances. So I'm glad I scratched a few backs before I got sick so they could scratch mine. But yeah, you know, some people are particularly adept at that. I don't expect all of my friends to be able to support me in that way. But I'm really grateful for the ones who are able to, because like you said, it does not come naturally. Not at all. I remember when I was a hospice intern being shocked. Like, I started driving around the city and looking at things differently, because there had been a house just maybe a couple blocks away from my home where a woman was in there dying. And I was like, my God, there are people dying everywhere and we never think about it. We just tuck our people away, you know, just you just crawl in bed there and, you know, just let's just, yeah. But yeah, I don't know. It's strange and too bad.
Do you think that people are afraid to have the discussion? Do you think it's like just a common fear?
I think people who are not near death are perhaps maybe just still kind of consumed with the sort of self-centeredness. I don't know. Or maybe I just remember being young and like worrying I'd say the wrong thing, you know, and, you know, maybe time, experience, or trauma, you just lose that concern. There's no time for it, you know, but I think maybe for myself, when, you know, earlier, I didn't want to talk about it, 'cause yeah, I thought I'd say the wrong thing. that I would support somebody in the wrong way, or yeah, it was a discomfort, but really for self-centered reasons, I think, if I were to reflect back on myself, but I can't speak for other people. I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I'm just thinking about our experience with this whole podcast and the different perspectives and thoughts on that topic. But we hope too that even just through this podcast that the people listening, it helps make the idea more comfortable, or it gives them the courage to think a little bit more about their own life and their own end of life as well. Because
it must be discomfort. It must be to some degree. Because people not wanting to complete advanced directives and stuff, I think it's denial. I think we're sort of wired to not want to face that death is real, right?
Yeah, it seems
too real.
I wonder if it's also with such wonderful advances in modern medicine that we do get that feeling like we can just fix everything and kind of get better. I don't know. It's hard to say. But yeah, that's a good point too, the advanced directive thing. I mean, it's a piece of paper, right? And it can be very difficult for some people to fill those out, which those are super important. We've heard from a lot of different people on this podcast just about how, it's important to take control of that part of their life and end of life. Otherwise, it can, be a pretty poor experience in some cases.
Oh my gosh. I mean, that was a lot. I've done advanced directives with countless people, especially in Las Cruces. That became kind of the thing that we were doing with folks.
That's something you'd like help them set up as well.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's okay, some of the cool. Most interesting conversations you'll ever have is working on somebody in their advanced directives. And nowadays it's so much more complicated. Like you have to, like all your online stuff, and you better have your passwords ready somewhere for someone to log on, because otherwise your debit card's going to keep running 100 different directions. And oh man, no. Yeah. You got to be ready. Got to be ready to die.
Yeah. It's yeah, exactly that. It's hardcore. I recently lost my grandpa, and we've been having to go through certain steps to close out just his life and everything. And it can be a total drag. Lucky for us, he was pretty good about keeping a lot of that stuff in order. He was a pretty classic old timer, so that made things easier for us. But
it's still hard, yeah. Though. That's the thing. Yeah, even if you have advanced directives, it's still hard. So
totally. But no, you're absolutely right. Where do you see medical aid and dying as we move forward? Do you think that it continues to expand and be adopted by other states?
I hope so. I mean, states like Arkansas worry me and make me think maybe a national initiative would be a good route to start pushing. One thing, the only thing that doesn't sit right with me for medical aid in dying, the only thing that makes me uncomfortable about it is that we have Medicaid not covering many, many treatments, right? So I have wonderful insurance. Lucky me, that's great. I work with a lot of clients that don't, right? So we have Medicaid that refuses to cover this or only cover so much of that or whatever. But it will cover medical aid in dying, for which I am grateful. Do not get me wrong. However, the only thing that sits kind of a little funky with me is, we need to be sure that we have full access healthcare for people, regardless of income. I don't think that it's a valid complaint like, oh, Medicaid won't cover my blah, 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 but it'll cover medical aid and dying. They just want to kill me off. I don't necessarily think that's a valid argument, but I think that sense and reality that we don't have great coverage for everybody is a problem. I don't like the connection of those two things. So I think that we need to work on healthcare coverage broadly, and then also maybe a national initiative. But, we learn a lot when states go state by state. I think that a lot was learned from New Mexico's legislation and them including physicians assistants and APNs and some of the tweaks that they made to the law. So I don't know which is best, but I'm just glad that there's momentum. I think that's really exciting.
Absolutely. So tell us about your experience, or I guess, if you don't mind, just overall, what your life will be like moving forward. You mentioned being stage four, you had treatment earlier today. Can I ask about your prognosis and just what that looks like?
Well, I think the problem with stage four is you never really truly know what your prognosis is going to be. I've been in a number of support groups, and while I feel, great for a year and a half, I've had no evidence of disease. I've heard story after story after story of people who say, well, for 5 years, it was no evidence of disease, which is great. 5 years is awesome. Or for 2 years, I had no, I just know that I, at some point, multiple times every day, am living in the reality of somebody with terminal cancer. It's regardless of where I'm at. And my body is just destroyed by this treatment that I've been through. But so I don't know what my prognosis is. My physician, my oncologist, really refuses to have any. I can't nail her down, and because she doesn't know either. So I think I have to live in that state and just know that, it will come back, or all of this chemo will. I mean, shoot, I had a clot the other day, pulmonary embolism. Yeah, that's it. Whew, that was a heart attack. I mean, there's always some shit going to happen, right? Like when you're messing with your body at this level for this long. I'm sure you're aware of that, which is why you took off time probably after starting a new treatment. You never really know how it's going to hit or how long it's going to work. So I don't know. I know that I'm a different person than I was before I had my diagnosis. In some ways better, in some ways not. But I know that the only thing I can prepare for maybe is that I would like to be able to hold those reins in the end. And I just know the end is coming sooner than I thought. I'm giving a lot of analogies, and maybe I'm uncomfortable myself saying that. I don't know, I think that, unfortunately, if I'm going to take part in medical aid and dying, I'm going to have to go to New Mexico. I keep an eye on Massachusetts because my brother lives there, and that would be my preference. I would like to die in my brother's house.
Yeah, that was actually my next question. Well, first, just beautifully said, the prognosis update. I appreciate that. And I can definitely relate to some of that. And following up, so you mentioned you're in Arkansas now, and a possibility would be New Mexico or possibly Massachusetts if things get moving over there. Can you tell us, have you envisioned what that experience would be like, or what you would want in that moment or in those final moments with medical aid and dying, if that's
the option I have.
You decided to pursue?
Yeah. Absolutely. I want to say that I'm really saddened to hear the woman who just flew from Massachusetts to New Mexico. It turns out that the little casita that she rented to live in with her husband until she uses medical aid and dying just wasn't really, as nice as they expected. It's a nice place, but it's in kind of like a they described it as like a difficult part of town. I don't know what that means. All I'm saying is, it's just kind of sad, right? Like, she probably envisioned, just like you're asking me to do, what will it look like? And I want to know, I'd like to know that I'm going to my brother's home. I'd love to know that I could be here. I've envisioned, it many times, and it's just so much more complicated to have to travel somewhere, way more complicated because my friends, you have to pick a date too, right? So my friend, she's having to choose a date so that she's flown there with her husband, but she's going to have friends fly in, right? Just like I'm envisioning, like, what am I going to, my parents, they're retired. Okay, that's good. But you have to, accommodate all of those things still to have the death that you would like. And it just gets tricky, and it shouldn't be. And so that pisses me off. But yeah, I think that I would want family there. I'm worried about my son because he's very young, but I would like to, for that reason, to be able to, as his mom, support him through my death, like to be able to manage it so that I can speak to him the way that I raised my daughter, you know, walk him through what's going to happen developmentally. He needs his mom to help him understand this. And I want to be able to do that while I'm functional, communicative, not absorbed in my own pain, physical pain, emotional pain, whatever. I want to be able to do that and then tell him goodbye. And so, yeah, I'm lucky enough to still have my parents. My mom is an amazing support, and I'd like to have her and my dear friends close to me. My daughter.
That sounds like a nice way to go with that support and those loved ones with you. And the one thing that I really try to hold on to through this whole experience and try to kind of frame in my own mind is that, yeah, even though no one wants to be in this situation, but there is still some good that comes out of it. And I think one of those is the opportunity to be surrounded by the people that you care about most in the world when you are on your way out of this world. Mm-hmm. And having that comfort and love is a peaceful and a nice way to go versus some of the other ways. So,
mm-hmm. You know, there's another social worker that I'm going to present with soon. And oh gosh, she's just amazing. I've met so many neat people through this process, but she's very active in Albuquerque, Santa Fe. She said she remembers that men didn't used to be allowed in the birthing rooms, right? Like that just wasn't a norm back in the day. And that just popped into my mind when I was thinking of my daughter. You know, she was there with my mom. So I gave birth to my son knowing I had cancer that had spread, and my mom and my daughter were there, each one holding my leg as I gave birth to my son. And it was beautiful. It was horrible, but it was beautiful. And that's the way I want to die. I want my children there. I want my daughter there to be supported by my mom and my son supported by my daughter. I mean, that is the way people should come into this world, and that is the way we should go. It shouldn't be so, I don't know, controlled. Ugh. Fine, include medicine and healthcare, but just let us control the details of it. It's going to happen. You can't stop a birth or a death from happening. It's coming. Yeah.
Have you talked a lot with your son about this? And how old is your son?
You don't mind me asking. He's 4. He doesn't have a clue. He knows mommy has cancer. He has a lot of questions about boobs because I've got one. My mom has none. And his sissy has 2. And he just doesn't. God, man, I tell you. Oh, boy. Yeah. He doesn't really understand. He understands that mommy gets sick and mommy has cancer and the doctor had to cut her. And sometimes I'm sicker than other times, but, you know, I'm so grateful I had the extra time to kind of get him prepared because I didn't know that I was going to have that time. Yeah. I was actually, visiting with hospice at one point. They told my mom I had 6 months to live. Yeah, I didn't think I would be here to do that. So it's really important to kind of prep him, I think.
Yeah, a super young kid. Mm-hmm. But just from talking with you and listening to your stories, it sounds like you've got such a good grasp on your situation and where you're going. And yeah, you're really easy to talk to, so I'm sure that your boy is in a good place with all of this. So a lot of credit to you there. Mm-hmm. What are you moving forward? What are your plans and goals or dreams as you just move on with life and balance these things.
I would never have done this before, but I got a subscription to Blue Apron and I try to enjoy those things. Mindfulness practice and, you know, really being in the moment, enjoying it. And listen, I am not Buddha. I'm telling you, like, I am a freaking mess, a hot mess a lot of the time. But I have gotten better at enjoying those little moments and those little things, or at least gotten back on track to doing that. But yeah, oh God, Blue Apron, oof, what a delicacy. So COVID's got me kind of bummed out. And yeah, I'm in the home, stuck in home. Once spring comes, I'll be outside and enjoying that more, because that's where I like to be, outside with my kids. So yeah. Yeah, I don't know if that answers your question, but enjoy things as much as I can. Enjoy my relationships, enjoy little experiences, since, you know, international travel is kind of off the table for now. And see my daughter become a woman.
It's beautiful stuff. Yeah, I'm right on board with that. Got to revel in those little things. I think that over time they really add up, and it's the good stuff. So I dig it. Very cool. Great answer. Hasban, do you want to jump in? You always have good questions.
This was a really cool interview, and you have a really cool way of speaking about everything. I think Andrew just asked you about your son. I guess that's really what I was curious about as you were speaking. I guess your son is only 4 years old, and me and Andrew both have nieces and like nephews that are, I guess, close to that age, and they're not even obviously people yet. But with your daughter, I guess she is a full-grown person. How have you spoken to her about it, and how has that, you know, shaped her life, I guess?
Oh, I wish she were here to answer that herself. She and I were... So I was a single mom for most of her life. We've just been very close as she was growing up. But then, you know, teenage years brought some karma back to mama. And I think that we were starting to hit that sort of natural rough adolescence patch when my diagnosis hit and then COVID hit. And so she moved out March 2020. And I don't know what I think. I was probably good, like being stuck at home with my, I mean, she's at that age where there has to be kind of a break. It just has to happen naturally. It's just those things, you know, those separations that take place, you know, novels are based on it, movies and whatnot. So I think that, again, I feel so lucky because it was sort of the worst, you know, with my son having just been born, with her having just had that period of breaking. And now I feel like she's been able to breathe a little easier with my prognosis having, you know, rebounded a bit. I didn't tell her that I had stage 4 cancer. I couldn't get it out for a long time. I just couldn't do it. And so I finally did, after talking to social worker, my hospice social worker, my mom, and my good friend, finally got the words out. And her first words were, she asked me, she said, "Are you scared?" And that's her. She's so empathetic, deeply empathetic. She's a very sensitive girl, and it's gonna be so good for her down the road. Long path, but she's just a beautiful, gentle soul. And you know, I think that maybe she didn't feel like she had permission to break from me as much when my health was really, really down. Both grateful, and we've had very emotional moments where we've just, you know, hugged and said how grateful we are that we've been able to come back to being close, but being her own person, you know, living her own life and her own expectations instead of mine, which is what I want for her. It's really all I want for her. But, you know, the turmoils of teenagers and their parents, but she's, yeah, she's going to do great. And I'm really glad that we've been able to, I don't know, grow together apart. Yeah. Oh, that girl with the tattoos, I tell you, Jesus.
That's a really cool description of your guys' like relationship, and felt really honest. And that's a really cool question for her to ask you, because that's what I always think of about too, the fear, because really we're all human and we get scared when we don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah. And I think that's at the root of a lot of the not wanting to talk about it, that discomfort with what we don't know, right? We just want to slap a nice, pretty explanation on it and say, how many people have just, oh my goodness, grabbed my hands, looked me dead in the eye, don't know me, right? And said, I just know Jesus is going to save you. And I'm like, okay, please let go. I don't know you, but thanks, but no thanks. I mean, that's isn't okay. Amazing? It's all like, right, but I don't know you.
Yeah, I really kind of
appreciate the love.
Yeah, it's good energy, right? It's like, that's kind of how I try to frame it. It's good energy and people really caring and trying to just hope good things. But at the same time, realism is important. And sometimes some of this stuff, yeah.
Exactly.
Barring some kind of
sometimes,
miracle.
Yeah. Sometimes you need somebody to be like, it's just going to be okay. And other times you need someone to be like, oh boy, this is going to be a shit show, you know? And it's just frustrating when it's the wrong person at the, you know, at right person at wrong time, you know? Yeah.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. What else? Is there anything else, Erica, that you'd like to share with the listeners? Anything about your journey or just social work or medical aid and dying? Anything that, you know, that you were thinking about, I guess?
Yes. First of all, check every lump as soon as possible. Secondly, get a second and third and fourth opinion if your insurance will cover it. And you be sure they won't cover it. If they say they won't, like, you know, double, triple check, and then get a second, third, and fourth opinion. Go to a specialist. Go to Mayo Clinic. Go to MD Anderson. Take part in trials, you know, or don't. These are all just know the buffet of options that are out there and take advantage. Oh my gosh, you can get free flights. I mean, find your social worker. You can get, you know, if you're dying, you can get trips to Disney World. Like, there are things you can do and take advantage. You know, dig around, do the digging, and don't give up. But when you do, it's not giving up. You know, enjoy the little moments and do what you can to have a peaceful end of life. Yeah.
Beautifully said. I love it.
Yeah.
Husband, do you have anything else to add?
No, I just really appreciate, I guess this is kind of a question for both of you guys, since you guys are so good at like speaking about this. You know, I could sense it in your voice that these are obviously difficult things to like speak about, like Erica. Does it help you deal with the reality of like having cancer? Like, has it helped talking about it? And yeah, if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, research shows that it does. What do you think, Andrew? I mean, you've made a whole job out of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. I guess for me, yes, this podcast in itself has kind of been like free therapy. I realized so many people with different perspectives and a lot of expertise on the subject, and then connecting with people like you, Erica, as well. I don't get a chance to talk to a whole lot of people who are in a similar position as myself, especially someone who's kind of, you know, younger as well. Mm-hmm. So you learn more, and it just gives you, I think, more of a chance to pump the brakes a little bit and think about this stuff and where you're at and recognize what's important and reflect. And like Erica mentioned, enjoy those little things as well. So yeah, it's definitely been helpful. I didn't really, I did a little bit of therapy during my time initially being sick and talked to some good people and stuff. And that was helpful too. But for me right now, this is, you know, this whole project has been a lot more helpful, I think, than anything. But go ahead, Erica, what's your take on everything?
Well, I think that you've created a support group for yourself. You're facilitating a support group. I mean, it is helpful in itself to talk. I mean, when anybody is, you know, posing questions or has a different situation to compare to your own, it leads your mind in places it hasn't gone before. And so you come up with alternate ways to cope or, you know, different perspectives to consider something from. So yeah, it's definitely helpful. You have other people that can, you know, become your partner and, you know, advocacy for something or to ask a question. I mean, it's widening your network of supports. And we know that people live longer who have those social networks. I mean, that's why social work is so important. So yeah, it, you know, it doesn't have a nice insurance code for reimbursement necessarily, but it's certainly worthwhile. We know that, you know, it's upstream medicine. There's like all these fancy words for it now. And I'm like, yeah. But it's definitely helpful. It's hard to quantify, but undoubtedly. Yeah.
Awesome. This was some good discussions. Anything else, Osman?
No, I think I'm good in the interest of time. I just really like appreciate you sharing your thoughts. And I know you guys talk about like how speaking about it has helped you guys. And just listening to, you know, the people that have been on the podcast, I think anyone that listens to it and spends time thinking about that and just the different ways people are living their lives today is really helpful. And your guys' conversation has brought a lot of perspective into my day, and I don't know how to quantify that like either, but I just wanted to share that with you.
Yeah, for sure. It's been so great talking to you guys. I can't wait to I've listened. I didn't even tell you. I think I listened to your podcast. I know I did, but it was like months ago.
Cool.
But Osman, are you on the podcast?
Yeah. So we kind of do it together. Andrew does a lot.
I did listen to it. Okay. Okay. Sorry.
Go ahead. We've been doing it for a while. How did you hear about it?
Yeah. Oh, you know, I was just medical aid and barn. What do we got for podcasts one day? And so doing the dishes. Yeah.
Awesome.
I was doing the dishes cool. Months ago, and I don't know, you know, I just started one yesterday. I don't have a good track record of like keeping on a single podcast, but oh my gosh, my dad wrote a porno. That's hilarious. Then another one, called Dear Therapist that I just started. So good. But yeah. So again, yes, I start and don't continue.
As a mom, I think you might enjoy episode 2. Andrew did an episode with his mom and Susie was really amazing on that episode.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of our more popular episodes as well. So yeah, if you get a chance, you should check out episode 2.
Oh, I definitely will. Oh, I don't know if I can. Yeah.
Yeah,
I
mean, sure. Really,
the parental thing is a real heart twister.
Yeah, she did a great job and she's a really good speaker like Andrew is. And it's not an easy conversation for her to have, but she showed a lot of courage and it was really powerful podcast.
Yeah, she's a very impressive woman. And I'll share briefly just because that episode, it's intertwined, but I'm also a childhood cancer survivor as well. When I was 4, I had been diagnosed with, it was a stage 4. It was a kidney cancer, but it had spread to the lungs. And so, you know, you can imagine my parents were about my age when I was sick. So it was pretty, you know, heavy stuff, obviously. But Susie does a great job. My mom, Susie, does a great job just speaking to all that and the current situation as well. It's a good episode 2, I think.
Oh my God. Childhood cancer. I cannot fathom what she's going through. So, I told you, Ira, my son is, he's, derived of a sperm donor, right? Well, he has siblings, right? Donor siblings. So we're in touch with like 25 families who have, you know, half Ira genes out there. It's really crazy. It's such a new world. Anyway, one of the siblings has cancer, and just watching their journey, I'm like, whew, I can make it through another day without complaining. Let me tell you what, because that is a whole nother level of awful. I don't know how parents make it through that. I just don't.
Yeah,
your mom must be one strong mama.
She is. She's the toughest customer I've ever met. I always worry about her too. And then I have to remind myself, like, dude, she's way more tough than any other person that, like myself and anyone I've met. So she's going to be okay. I know, regardless of how these things play out.
She's got good friends.
Yeah. Good friends. Yeah. She's, and you know, we got a great family. My parents, they divorced back in 2014, but they really came together when I got sick, and it's made such a huge difference. I mean,
2014 is pretty recent, huh?
It is. It's again, they're so they love each other. They're amicable. They just had to go in a different direction, and that obviously was tough, I think, for everybody. But again, the fact that I got this sick pretty shortly after all of that, and they were able to just again come back together and be so supportive and helpful has been tremendous, because they don't have to be that way.
Ideal.
People can be nasty. Yeah.
And rare.
Yeah, it is. It's extremely rare. Yeah, I'm really proud and thankful for both of them. So cool. Well, this is awesome, Erica. We really enjoyed talking to you. Hopefully we can do it again sometime. Yeah. Well,
you guys stay in touch and let me know if you're like, we're looking for a different angle. And maybe is there anybody that has this characteristic or something? Just holler at me and I'll see who we have out there. Cause I've gotten to know a lot of people this way, and it's a cool bunch. So.
That sounds good. We'll do that. And
thank you again.
Group to be a part of, and thanks for everything, and we'll be in touch, and we're thinking of you and good vibes, and wish you well on your journey.
Thank you. You as well. See you later.
All right. Bye. Thanks.